From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. As the late Lakers announcer Chick Hearn used to say, it's nervous time. In Sacramento, a contentious bill reining in independent contracting has to be ironed out by the end of the session in a couple weeks. Now Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash are threatening to go directly to voters to potentially overturn what the legislature does. We'll get the latest right after the news. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I sure hope you have a wonderful Labor Day weekend lined up. Weekend where we pay tribute to those who work so hard and service in so many different fields. Hope you get a rest on Monday, able to take the day off. We're going to do our best to help you enjoy the 3 days if you got it off, talking about movies on Film Week next hour. Later this hour, a new study looks at the genetics of same-sex attraction. We'll also focus on concerns about the long-term use of antidepressants and how to balance their benefits against those potential risks. But first, the clock is ticking in Sacramento, where the legislature has just a couple of weeks to finish up its bills. Perhaps the most contentious and far-reaching is AB 5. It would codify the state Supreme Court's Dynamex decision restricting companies' labeling of employees as independent contractors. Depending on its final form, the bill could upend the business model of the ride-hailing companies. It could also hit truckers hard who own their own vehicles. Well-funded Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash are now threatening to go straight to voters if AB 5 doesn't have a carve-out exempting their drivers from employee status. With us to talk about the very latest, Carolyn Saeed, who covers business and technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. She specializes in the gig economy. Carolyn, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So this is coming right up to the wires. Are there any new developments even this morning you can share with us?
Well, actually, the bill is going to be heard in the Senate Appropriations Committee in about an hour. The bill author, Lorena Gonzalez, told me yesterday that she thinks it will go through. However, I have also heard a lot of rumors coming out of Sacramento that many legislators and even the governor would like to kick it down the road to 2020 because it's so complicated. There's so many fast-moving parts, and there are so many industries, not just the gig companies and the truckers, but many other industries that are seeking exemptions and that they think it might be better to just pause.
Well, the last time we talked about this on the program, we were inundated by calls from people who had real concerns about how this would affect their livelihoods. And of course, we've heard from many people who feel like the independent contractor status has been used as a ruse by companies so that they don't have to provide benefits, legal protections, many of the other things that come with being a permanent employee of the company. But I have to assume the legislators are just getting hammered from all sides here.
Yes, and I think Steve can probably talk about that too, but I'm sure there is a lot of lobbying going on.
Speaking of Steve, Steve Smith joining us, Communications Director for the California Labor Federation, an association of some 1,200 unions statewide. Ms. Smith, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So what's your sense of where things stand? Is it possible there won't be a bill by the end of this session?
We don't think so. We think the bill has got tremendous momentum now. It will be heard, as Carolyn said, in the Appropriations Committee today. Assuming it passes out of the Appropriations Committee, it goes to the Senate floor. We think legislators understand the importance of this bill to provide basic protections to literally millions of workers who have been cheated out of those protections for years. We've now got six presidential candidates on the record supporting AB 5. That's unheard of for a piece of state legislation. So again, we think we've got tremendous momentum. We're looking forward to the vote in the Senate.
And you're not concerned if the ride-hailing companies fund a ballot initiative to attempt to undo AB 5?
What concerns me is the ballot is that these companies say they've got $90 million to go to the ballot to continue cheating workers out of basic rights, and yet they claim poverty that they can't pay these workers even a minimum wage. That is concerning to me. If they do go to the ballot, look, we're ready for that. We think that we have a good case to make to California voters. In fact, a recent national poll showed that 71% of Americans said that gig workers should receive the same rights and benefits as traditional employees. Among gig workers, that number was 87%. So I think this is going to be a very tough sell for these big corporations to make in the state of California.
Now, you mentioned the $90 million the three companies are talking about putting up for a ballot initiative. My understanding, though, is the companies are not profitable. My assumption is that this money would come from what they have as their investor funds, but the companies are not profitable themselves, are they?
Well, you know, you can define that any way you want. Uber's been valued at $90 billion, and yes, that's investor money, but they've got enough money to pay their CEO some $15 million a year, to pay their top executives multi-million dollar packages and golden parachutes. So we don't think these companies are poor. What we do think is that they've built a model based on exploitation of their workers, their drivers. And that's what essentially the Dynamex decision was about. And that's what AB 5 is about, getting justice for these workers.
We're talking with Steve Smith, Communications Director of the California Labor Federation. We reached out to Uber. The company declined our interview request, but provided us this statement. Right now, California lawmakers and labor leaders have a historic opportunity to dramatically improve the quality and security of independent work, strengthen the 21st century labor movement, and protect our innovation economy by acting on the proposal Uber has proudly set forth, a guaranteed minimum earning standard that would provide stability for drivers while allowing them the flexibility to earn more and work when, where, and for whom they choose, access to robust portable benefits like sick leave and injury protection, and for the first time in the modern history of the labor movement, real sectoral bargaining rights for drivers, giving them a voice in the decisions that affect their livelihoods. While we continue to advocate for this progressive framework, circumstances are forcing us to plan for legislative inaction by laying the groundwork for this initiative. That's the statement from Uber. Mr. Smith, your response to their statement.
Well, for one, what they're proposing, we think, is a lot of smoke and mirrors. They talk about a guaranteed wage, but the amount that they've set, when you figure in the expenses that drivers have to take on as contractors, ends up being about $7 or $8 an hour. That's well below the state minimum wage. And we heard this morning in the New York Times, Uber's Tony West was quoted as saying his company is going to ignore the law if it passes. Is that really the point we've reached in America, where big corporations have become so powerful they can pick and choose the laws they want to follow and the laws they don't? If so, we think it's time for a correction, and perhaps California voters will have the opportunity to make that correction next November.
Steve Smith, California Labor Federation, with us. Carolyn Saeed of the San Francisco Chronicle. Uber and Lyft, DoorDash, a number of these other gig economy type companies have built their model on this kind of compensation plan for their employees. What's your sense of if the status of drivers, particularly for the ride hailers, changes, what's that going to do to those companies?
Well, they would take a tremendous financial hit. The $30 million per company they've put up for the ballot initiative so far is nothing compared to what it would cost them if their drivers were employees. Barclays did an analysis and said Uber would pay about an extra $500 million a year and Lyft an extra $290 million a year. It comes to maybe $3,600 per driver for the basic benefits that employees have, like workers' comp, payroll taxes, and some training, Medicare, unemployment. So that's a huge hit right there. The other things that the companies say, and some workers agree with this, is that they would lose the flexibility that the workers and the companies rely on in the business model, that if they had to pay workers from the moment that they logged on, they would restrict how many workers could log on at any given time because they don't want to be paying people who are just sitting in their car or who log on at 3 a.m. So they would make it much harder to go to work for them. And people would, you know, have to have maybe scheduled shifts instead of the flexibility to punch in and punch out at will. That is still up in the air, whether that is actually the case or whether that is something they are saying for now.
Carolyn, do you have a sense if AB 5 doesn't pass, you've still got the state Supreme Court decision, which calls into question this independent contractor status. So if there's no bill, what happens?
So the most of AB 5 is still the law of the land, thanks to the Dynamex decision, although Dynamex only applied to wage orders. It didn't apply to the whole broad range of employment benefits, which AB 5 would broaden it. However, Dynamex, despite being the law of the land, has not resulted in widespread reclassification. It's only enforced through individual cases or through state entities like the Labor Commission filing cases, and there just haven't been that many. And in terms of lawsuits, almost all of the drivers are barred from class action lawsuits because they agreed to individual mandatory arbitration when they signed their employment contracts. So they can only go one at a time, as opposed to the power of a class action lawsuit where millions of drivers could join forces.
We're talking with Carolyn Saeed. She covers the gig economy and technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. Also with us from the Western States Trucking Association, Director of Governmental Affairs and Communications, Joe Rakovats. Joe, thank you for being with us again. Where do your truck drivers stand and truck owner companies on AB 5 as it's currently constituted?
Well, currently, as AB 5 is constituted, it would end, we believe, the owner-operator model in the trucking industry here in California. And half of our members are one-truck owner-operators. Yes, they have their own operating authority, but AB 5 would even affect how those folks are able to continue to exist in the marketplace. We do fundamentally believe that the sins of a few at the ports, LA, and Long Beach have been expanded to include the entire industry. I myself was an owner-operator for 25 years, but three kids through college. You know, being an owner-operator is a choice oftentimes. The few players at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach who did coerce drivers into what are called lease purchase schemes, you know, they did misclassify. We do agree with that. But AB 5 goes so far as to eliminate the entire independent contractor model within the trucking industry.
What happens then for those folks who invested in buying their trucks, presumably have ongoing payments for them? What then happens if AB 5 passes as it is now?
You know, there's, you know, what we consider kind of a lot of wishful thinking that somehow the motor carriers themselves will buy the trucks and then make the drivers employees. That is not going to happen. You know, similar to the airline industry, you know, an airline tries to operate one type of aircraft to reduce maintenance costs. You know, trucking companies are not going to operate a smorgasbord of different types of trucks and then employ the drivers to operate that. It's they definitely want to stick with one brand of truck. This model has actually existed in the trucking industry for many years. I was a Teamster driver early in my career in early 80s, and it was called the two-check system, where the so-called owner-operator owned the truck and leased it to a motor carrier, got a truck check, and then was an employee of the motor carrier. The last vestige of that was here on the West Coast with the auto haulers, and that has gone by the wayside.
If there is a ballot measure by the ride-hailing companies to try and overturn AB 5 or to set for them a specific carve-out for ride-hailing, is that something that your members might consider joining in, or do they not have the financial resources to be a significant part of that initiative?
Well, certainly we've heard the news as of yesterday that the ride-hailing companies are threatening to go the ballot measure. With that said, it's really unknown to us what sort of language would be present in a ballot measure. Would it be specific to the ride-hailing companies? It seems to me, personally, that if that were the case, it probably wouldn't be a very successful ballot measure. It would have to be pretty broad in its appeal to attract enough voters.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us. That's Joe Rakovats, Director of Governmental Affairs and Communications for the Western States Trucking Association. Also, my thanks to Steve Smith, Communications Director, California Labor Federation. Just a couple weeks are left for the California legislature to pass AB 5. It gets its committee hearing this afternoon. And Carolyn Saeed, San Francisco Chronicle, gig economy and tech reporter, with us as well. We'll see what happens and be very closely following here on Air Talk and throughout the next couple of weeks, our local and statewide coverage here on KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about a new study that looks at potential genetics in same-sex attraction. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Coming up next hour, Film Week on KPCC. In addition to reviews of this week's movies, The Frame's John Horn is in Telluride, that beautiful Colorado Rocky Mountain town, which triples in population every year for the four-day film festival, which typically provides insight into who the Oscar nominees are going to be. Up until last year, they had, for 8 or 9 years in a row, had every Best Picture winner getting its debut in the U.S. at Telluride, as well as most of the Oscar nominees for Best Picture. John with us to preview the Telluride Festival just getting underway. Right now, I think he's interviewing Renee Zellweger for her film in which she plays a late-in-life Judy Garland. We turn our attention right now to a study that was released yesterday by the journal Science, looking at potential genetic indicators for same-sex attraction. It was genomic-wide research on DNA from nearly 500,000 adults in the United States and the UK. The study identified 5 genetic variants that had not previously been linked with gay or lesbian sexuality. The variants were more common in people who reported having had a same-sex sexual partner. But, you know, one confounding element here is that we're not talking about people who just self-identify as gay or lesbian. It also includes people who have had just same-sex experience. That may not be their identity. With us to talk about what we learned from the study and what it adds to this piece of research into genetics of same-sex attraction is director of the Center for Genetic Medicine Research at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., Dr. Eric Villain. Dr. Villain, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What do you see as the significance of the findings? What piece does this add?
You know, first of all, as you said, it's a very large study. It's a very impressive study by its sheer size. It's the largest genetic study on same-sex sexual attraction that has ever been published before. And it really looked at genetic variance between the individuals who were heterosexuals and all the individuals who were, as they call in the study, non-heterosexual. And as you mentioned, it was based only on their behavior, meaning individuals who have had at least one same-sex sexual experience, which is different, as you mentioned, than sexual identity as a gay or lesbian identity.
One of the things I was wondering is if these 5 genetic variants could be about openness to experiences that aren't in the mainstream, but giving the appearance of having to do with same-sex attraction. Is that possible?
Yes, of course, it's possible. I have to say, though, that the strength of the genetic effect, and that's one of the major findings here is that the strength of genetics is not very high. So yes, there are five new variants in genes that had not been associated with same-sex sexual attraction before that have been discovered. So it confirms that there is a genetic element to same-sex sexual attraction, but it also tells us that this effect is relatively small, leaving open the possibility for other influences, such as what happens during pregnancy, what we sometimes call the environment. So this is quite interesting, and what it tells us really is that this simplistic notion of one gay gene determining sexual orientation is really not the way to look at it. We have now a much more complex and nuanced painting of what sexuality is in humans.
If you have questions for Dr. Eric Villain, joining us from the Center for Genetic Medicine Research, Children's National Medical Center in D.C., he directs the center there. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you want to ask about the study, what its findings are, and the piece that it adds to the ongoing research between genetics, environment, and same-sex attraction, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Villain, do the findings here dovetail with what we know from twin studies about higher likelihood of same-sex attraction?
They do in a sense, because twin studies, which started in the early 1990s, told us that there was some genetic influence on same-sex sexual attraction, and that came from studies of identical twins asking the question, well, if one of the twins is gay, for example, what are the chances of the other one to be also gay? And in the earlier studies, this likelihood was about 50%. So it was not 100%, which would have meant it's completely genetically determined. But what really made us understand that there was a genetic effect was that if you look at now twins who are fraternal, only sharing half of their genome, then, and you ask, what is the likelihood of one twin to be gay if the other co-twin is gay, then it drops from 50% to about 20. And that means that there is a genetic effect. So the study confirms that, but what it tells us is it's a relatively small part. It's there, but it's small influence compared to other potential factors.
Would there be a way to follow up with the subjects of this study to find those who had these five DNA variations? And for those who did not identify a same-sex experience, against behavior that's looked at here, to see what the factors might be, were there environmental blocks, for example, religious views or other things that might have kept them from acting on what these five DNA variants might have otherwise led to?
You bring up a very good point, which is that what is actually measured is a report of people on past behavior. And two things, of course, could happen. One is that they don't necessarily tell the interviewer exactly what happened. And the second thing that I think you're leading to is that there may be thoughts of attraction, but they were never acted upon because of societal constraints. There are many parts of the world in which it's, in fact, not only frowned upon, but quite dangerous sometimes to enact on same-sex attraction. So certainly this study does not capture that. For example, it is mostly a study that has a population of European ancestry, and we don't know what this study would have shown in other parts of the world with other ethnicities. Your idea of following up and see what could happen or asking further question is possible. I'm not sure how practical it is.
Okay. Pippi asked the page on the AirTalk page, so I understand correctly, the research means there's not one but several genes contributing to same-sex attraction. Are all of those variants typically related to same-sex attraction, or are they could you have one, two, three of the variants that would potentially have the same effect?
It's a great question. There are not they've not been known to be candidates for sexual attraction, but some of these variants do put us into a place where we could follow up on the mechanism. For example, there is a variant that deals with olfaction, the sense of smell, olfactory receptors. And the sense of smell has a lot to do with sexual attraction. So it's a lead that's really quite interesting. And there is another variant that has to do with baldness. And you can say, well, baldness has nothing to do with sexual attraction. Well, it might, because baldness is often related to higher levels of male hormone testosterone. So there are really a number of interesting leads that will certainly generate a lot of follow-up research on this study.
So the variant, you take, for example, the male pattern baldness gene, was the variant showing an association, at least, between those more likely to have male pattern baldness and those more likely to have same-sex attraction?
No, it was not identified this way. It is just that the variant that's in a gene that is normally associated with male pattern baldness was also associated with same-sex sexual attraction.
So it's just the gene itself. It's not actually how the gene worked in the body.
Correct.
Okay. All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. All of the subjects in this study, as I understand it, were of European ancestry. Is there potentially a genetic difference that you would see with non-European ancestral subjects?
Absolutely. And the authors of the study make it clear that it is a limitation of the study, which is the lack of diversity of the sample. In addition to what we were discussing earlier about the fact that depending on the various geographical and cultural parts of the world in which same-sex sexual attraction behavior may be heavily influenced by societal constraints, there are also real genetic differences between various ethnicities that may lead to different genes being shown, being associated if it was done in a different part of the world.
All right. Professor, I want to thank you so much for being with us and talking about this study that was published yesterday in the journal Science. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
He directs the Center for Genetic Medicine Research at D.C.-based Children's National Medical Center. He studied sexual development for over 30 years. Dr. Eric Villain with us on AirTalk. We've got a link to the study on our AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Coming up on Film Week, we'll hear about the movies Don't Let Go. We'll also hear about the documentary Untouchable, which looks at movie producer Harvey Weinstein, and John Horn of The Frame is at the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado at that small mountain town. We're going to hear from John about some of the films getting the biggest buzz there. And if they get buzz at Telluride, there's a very good chance that they're going to be in Oscar consideration in some way, shape, or form. We'll get the preview of those movies coming up. It's Air Talk on KPCC, back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurtis. As large numbers of Americans have taken antidepressants over an extended period of time, one of the ongoing questions for medical researchers is, what are the potential harms of long-term antidepressant use? And if there are quantifiable harms, how do you balance that with the benefits of the drugs for people who suffer from chronic depression? According to a piece in the Wall Street Journal, there is a growing concern in the healthcare industry that those who are on long-term antidepressant pharmaceutical therapy, that their risks of potentially dangerous side effects are there and increase over time, whether you're talking about stroke, heart attacks, or even premature death. But of course, depression also has high risks associated with it. Joining us to talk about those trade-offs and how to get an accurate sense of what the trade-offs are is Dr. Mark Olfson. He's Columbia University Irving Medical Center Professor of Psychiatry and Epidemiology. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Olfson.
Nice to be here with you, Larry.
Let's talk first of all about just the difficulty in trying to determine what the potential risks of long-term antidepressant use are. What's just the challenge in getting reliable numbers on that?
Well, yeah, part of the challenge with studying any rare but serious a potential side effect of medication is you can't study it directly the way you do, say, study how effective the treatments are, in this case for depression. You have to go about it in an indirect way using large amounts of more superficial data and looking for statistical associations. And we all know that associations aren't necessarily causal. So it's a very difficult challenge to try to tie down the rare but serious side effects associated with medication.
So when you look at this meta-analysis, 14% higher risk of heart attacks and strokes, 33% greater risk of death, these could be attributable to the fact that these are individuals prone to depression, could have other health conditions associated with it. This may have nothing to do with the medication.
That's right. And, you know, even though the researchers have done a job, you know, as fine a job as they possibly can with the data they have, it's just a very difficult thing because there are a lot of things that aren't measured. And just as you say, it leaves you end up with a set of questions, but questions that are not nevertheless concerning.
One of the things I also read a lot about, there's concern in the medical community that such a high percentage of people taking antidepressants had them prescribed by their primary care doctor, not by a psychiatrist. But, you know, just given the limited access that most people have to psychiatrists or the expense or time of having a psychiatric workup to determine the suitability of antidepressants, is that really realistic that you would have the majority of people seen by a psychiatrist instead of by a primary care doc?
You know, it really is not realistic. I think that this system we have in which most of the prescriptions are written not by psychiatrists but by other physicians is going to be the system that we have for the foreseeable future. Hopefully, though, that practices can evolve in a way so that more complicated cases, psychiatrists can be brought in, sometimes just in the background in a consulting way, in models that are called collaborative care. But that's the way it's been for many, many years, and I don't see that aspect, the basic aspect of having primary care docs and other non-psychiatrists doing most of the prescribing. I don't see that changing.
Well, I wonder about your general sense of the critique that antidepressants are overprescribed because you're lead author of a paper that found that a distinct minority of U.S. adults with major depression are getting any kind of help, including antidepressant drugs.
Well, you know, I think that there is evidence both, and this is difficult sometimes to kind of grapple with. It's both the case that these medications are overprescribed and underprescribed. There are doubtless lots of people who have depression who suffer with it for years and receive no treatment whatsoever. And there are other people who are continued on these medications far longer than they need to be. So we're struggling as a nation with both problems.
Also with us to talk about the challenge, Dr. Steven Siegel, who's professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the USC Keck School of Medicine. Dr. Siegel, great to have you with us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on the piece this morning.
How do you think physicians can best get at the trade-offs, whatever they are, associated with long-term antidepressant use and potential negative health effects of that versus, in many cases, people needing the long-term treatment?
So I think you've really hit the nail on the head there in recognizing and acknowledging that there are risks to non-treatment. And that when we sit with a patient, a particular patient in front of us, as opposed to a population, what we're trying to do is balance the risks of action and the risks of inaction. And we know, as you also alluded to earlier, that untreated depression, or a slightly different concept, which would be treated depression, which is not fully resolved. So the presence of depression, regardless of treatment, that those symptoms also have tremendous adverse consequences, ranging from huge increases in morbidity and mortality from non-mental health causes. So depression or depressive symptoms dramatically increase death by myocardial infarction and other coronary artery disease, as well as the direct risks and morbidity of being depressed. So we have to think about all of that in trying to decide what to do for this person right here, right now.
The first generation of antidepressants, and I guess I'm thinking of, you know, Prozac, Zoloft, their generics, and they've been out there for decades now. And I just wonder, are we going to be able to have more reliable data on what those potential risks are, just given you've got some people who've been taking those drugs for, you know, 30, 40 years?
So I think we do know some of those risks, and not at the level that you were talking about earlier in terms of having, you know, large prospective double-blind controlled trials that would assess that. That, I agree, it's not easy to conceive of how that would happen, because we wouldn't leave people untreated to assess those side effects. On the other hand, we know what some of the risks are, how they can be mitigated, and how people can look for them. So, for example, things like drug-drug interactions and the effects of some of those medicines that might impact things like clotting time. And this, I think, also speaks to the very last issue you just discussed, which is access to expert mental health care. And while I unfortunately concur that I don't see a solution in the near term that would allow Americans in general and people in particular areas and from specific groups to have better access to psychiatrists, that's really what we need. We need to treat mental health as if it matters. Nobody would, I think nobody would be satisfied if we said, there's just not enough cardiologists, there's just not enough neurologists. So if you have a stroke, we're just going to send it to someone who does everything and hope for the best and recognize that there's just not enough care.
As we continue, I want to come back to you, though, because I understand what you're saying, and you're certainly, as a psychiatrist, going to be able to speak about the advantages of someone with specialized training. But I'm interested, too, what the role is of medical schools in preparing primary care docs, as few as there are, sadly, coming out of medical school these days, to be better positioned to help their patients make the call on antidepressants. We're taking your calls as well with your questions for our guests, Drs. Mark Olson, Dr. Steven Siegel. We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We have questions about the long-term use of antidepressants, the pros and cons, and efforts of medical researchers to understand better what the potential negative trade-offs are. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Film Week coming up. Our critics are going to review Official Secrets starring Keira Knightley and Matthew Good. Also, Untouchable, a new documentary from Ursula McFarlane that looks at the life of Harvey Weinstein. And David Oyelowo stars in Don't Let Go, a thriller that's out this week from Jacob Estes, the writer and director. And our own John Horn of the Frame is in Telluride for that terrific boutique festival, which every year brings us the creme de la creme of American films, those most likely to be Oscar nominated or Best Picture Award winners. Right now, our focus on the long-term use of antidepressants with USC Keck School of Medicine professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Dr. Steven Siegel, from Columbia University Irving Medical Center, professor of psychiatry and epidemiology, Dr. Mark Olson, is also with us. So, Dr. Siegel, is there more that medical schools should be doing, in your view, to help primary care physicians be better equipped to help their patients in the determination whether they should start or stay on antidepressants?
Well, I think it may be a bit unrealistic to assume that we can just push more knowledge, more expertise, and more responsibility into the frontline primary care doctors as a mechanism to really, you know, avert the core problem with our system, which is that we don't incentivize appropriate treatment. It's really an economic issue. So, yes, I'm sure we can educate people better on depression and give them some more knowledge about antidepressants, but these are the kinds of issues that if you're not practicing them regularly, you're just not going to have the depth of knowledge to do it well. So collaborative care models, as Dr. Olson alluded to, that may be the compromise, to have true expertise embedded in those practices in ways that you can interact between professionals right here, right now, share knowledge, and do the best for the patient.
Just in the use of antidepressants, the most recent federal survey that was undertaken from 2011 to 2014 shows 13% of teen and adult Americans said they took antidepressants over the past month during the survey period, 13%. And that is up from 7.7% during the previous survey period of 1999 to 2002. Again, this would be Americans who just within the last month of the survey period had used antidepressants. It's safe to assume that the percentage is far higher if you look at people who at some point earlier in their lives had been prescribed antidepressants. Dr. Mark Olson, your thought about what opportunity there is in medical schools to better address this?
Yeah, well, I think it's first important to recognize that that the quality of depression care in primary care, while it's still, there are a lot of areas that are potentially problematic, and there's certainly a lot of room for improvement. There has been some improvement over time. It's now the case that screening is more widely available, And the concept that depression is a persistent, often a persistent condition rather than simply an episodic condition is, I think, more widely diffused. But I agree with Dr. Siegel. It in some basic way, so much more with each passing year is being passed along to primary care as knowledge of health and medical care expands, that at some point it becomes unreasonable to expect them to be able to practice with the level of expertise necessary to derive the optimal effectiveness out of the treatments that we have. So there's only so much, I think, that can be done during medical school to prepare, and during residency to prepare future primary care physicians to manage their patients who have depression. But there are some basic things that can be done, and that at some schools are and residency programs are being done, and some of them are actually very general, involving teaching young doctors how to, for example, evaluate suicide and suicide risk, which is an extremely important aspect of managing people who have serious depression.
Molly in South Los Angeles says, I'm a social worker and I work for the LA County Department of Mental Health. I've seen antidepressants work wonders with some of the patients I've seen, but at the same time, I've seen doctors prescribe them to patients when the doctors don't truly understand what the underlying problem is. There is also the issue of patients being monitored who are taking antidepressants long-term. And I wonder, Dr. Wolfson, if that's an area where more needs to be done to make sure that, you know, consistent tracking is going on, that the prescriptions aren't just sort of automatically renewed long term.
I think it's absolutely an area that deserves more attention. And one of the things that, one of the more alarming things that, you know, we found in our research is that most of the people who are prescribed antidepressants, when you look into their claims records and into their medical records, you don't see any evidence of any mental health problems. So these are medications, very much the way statins, medications to lower cholesterol, sometimes are being used in primary care. They're just being passed along month after month and sometimes year after year without any actual reevaluation of the mental health of the patient.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us and talking about the challenges in studying what the long-term effects are of patients taking antidepressants, and also talking about the significant positive effects that the medications can have in the shorter and longer term. Dr. Steven Siegel, USC Keck School of Medicine, chairs the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, where he's also a professor, and Dr. Mark Olson, joining us from Columbia University's Medical Center. He, too, professor of psychiatry, also of epidemiology at Columbia. Just want to take a moment to remind you, not only is Film Week coming up, we've got special programming coming up, 1A here Monday for the Labor Day holiday. I'll be off for the holiday, but back with you Tuesday. Our typical weekly check-in on the world of politics will come your way Tuesday instead of Monday because of Labor Day. I want to thank our terrific Air Talk team. Without each of these individuals, we simply couldn't bring you the kinds of guests and topics that we do each day. They're deeply dedicated, led by our senior producer, Fiona Ng. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio and Natalie Chudnovsky. Lindsay Wright with us as well this week, and help from Caroline Champlin. Our news apprentices are Matt Bynum and Ari Saperstein, and our engineer is Parker McDaniels. Film Week is coming up next. We're going to hear from our critics, also what they think are the most notable films to this point as we conclude the summer. What are the best films so far before we head into the typical award consideration season of the year? It's Air Talk on KPCC. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Got a three-day weekend, a lot of chance for you to go see movies, and we'll tell you about the new ones at your local theater. Our critics this week are Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, Tim Cockshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Don't Let Go, a thriller starring David Oyelowo and Storm Reid. It tells the story of a detective who has to solve a crime across time when he gets a shocking phone call from his niece, Ashley, 2 weeks after her murder.
I don't understand.
There's a crime that in your time hasn't yet happened. Your dad's gonna die. Your mom's gonna die. And so are you. But as long as you're alive, you can change things.
Don't Let Go, written and directed by Jacob Estes. It's rated R. Christy, what'd you think of it?
So it's kind of a bunch of stuff going on here at once. It is a time travel, sci-fi, police, murder, mystery thriller. And that is a lot. And that is a lot to put on the shoulders of even an actor as esteemed and as extremely versatile and capable as David Oyelowo. I'm not sure the time travel element really works here. I'm not sure you actually even need it. But that is the gimmicky kind of through line that is happening. David Oyelowo plays this LA police detective who discovers that his brother, the brother's wife, and their teenage daughter have all been killed. It might be a murder-suicide, but it might be something else going on here. And then he starts getting mysterious cell phone calls from the teenage daughter. And there is a kind of weird conflict between the gritty realism of modern day Los Angeles and the supernatural, metaphysical, time travel, how are they connecting with each other part of it, which leads to a few kind of cool gimmicks. But on the whole, I was so taken out by the whole time travel element, trying to figure out how does this work, does this work, and then ultimately it does not work.
Well, the thing about the time travel element, only Andy Klein can figure that out. So, you know.
The greatest time travel critic of all time.
Yes. Only Andy can do that. So I'm watching this time travel thing. I'm thinking to myself, do I really care about that? No, I don't. What I do care about in this movie is that little girl and her uncle. That's a love story.
Storm Reid.
And he is going to do everything he can to save his niece from this thing happening to her. And that straight ahead, thrilling, I'm going to save my family part of this movie is the part that I love. David Oyelowo is just playing a straight up, just as dramatic as you can possibly play it. And in the way that movies of this ilk work, there have been a bunch of these movies, by the way. Frequency was one of them, I don't know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, which James I liked. Well, I know not
movie.
All critics did,
you know,
but I
like that movie. I'm sorry when these, Nick Cage has made like 8 of them. not all of his work, but
although
when these
maybe
movies
if
work,
could
they
go
work.
Back in time and keep him from making
some of those movies.
Some of them are kind of fun, actually. But
pretty sharp. This movie originally written set on a farm with you know a white family, and the guy was not a cop and all that kind of stuff. David Oyelowo gets it, and he decides he wants to do it, and it was his idea to take it and set it in contemporary Los Angeles to make the guy a cop. Michael T. Williamson is in this movie. Tyree Henry is in this movie. And, of course, Young Storm. Now, this is the thing that David deciding to take that movie meant. It meant that all of those African-American actors and actresses got jobs. Because now this is an entirely different movie than it would have been, say, 20 years ago when they made Frequency. And to my measure, they've done a pretty good job here.
And what's cool is that you have David Oyelowo and Storm Reid, who were both stars of two Ava DuVernay films, mm-hmm. Selma and A Wrinkle in Time, now working together. And you see parts of L.A. you don't ordinarily see. Even in a cop film, you see kind of grittier and more neighborhoody parts of L.A. that we don't always see on film, including like the Pump Jack area,
yeah.
Kenneth Hahn. You know,
Park,
or, yeah.
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 Yeah, so it is inventive in that way, but I was just distracted the whole time.
The time travel.
Michael T. Williamson, didn't he start as a teen actor?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was White Shadow, was
oh,
that? Yeah.
Yeah, he goes
yeah,
back
he's
years.
Very, very
that's
long.
Academy, that's an Academy Award nominated actor there, Forrest Gump.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Don't Let Go, David Oyelowo and Storm Reid, written and directed by Jacob Estes. It's rated R in wide release. The comedy Give Me Liberty stars Chris Gallust and Lauren Lolo Spencer. The film is directed by Kirill Minkanovsky. Tim, what'd you think?
Well, this little film just came out of nowhere and gobsmacked me. I almost didn't even watch it, you know, because it's on the list. And it's way down there at the bottom of the list, and you have these more important films. I'm like, I'm going to watch this movie. And I'm watching this movie, and it just wrapped me. Most of it takes place in one of these medical transport vehicles. You have this young man, Russian young man, his Russian family, all of these old people, some of them with disabilities of one sort or another. It's very Desika in the way that it's constructed, because all of these people are who they are. and they have the disabilities that they have. And he's gathering them all together to take them to all the places they got to go. And it's just a mess and a nightmare. But it's the most fun and thrilling, just adventure film. There's a funeral that they have to go to, and it just goes all goofy. And he picks up this young black woman who's actually a social worker, and then he has to pick up the person for whom she's a social. She's in a wheelchair, and she is just hysterical in this movie, the way she's backseat driving. It's just this fun, fun film that was very heartfelt and kind of moving, and most of it takes place in that van.
This film is tremendous. It is far and away the best movie of the week and one of the best movies of the year. And what it pulls off is just a little miracle, because so often you make a film with non-actors and that can be so hit and miss. It can seem kind of stiff and stagey and artificial. This rings with such authenticity from the very, very beginning. You are in this van with these people and it's a thrill ride. It's like this controlled chaos, and it feels totally improvised, and there's no way that it was, because there's too much going on. This is a plot-heavy movie. A lot happens here. But you feel as if you are truly immersed with this array of people. It goes from thrilling, funny farce to just heartbreaking and intimate. There's a whole sequence toward the end that's kind of violent that I was like holding my breath. It's so intense. I do not know how this filmmaker pulled this off. It's only a second film.
Yeah.
And he had been a medical transport driver himself.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
And he's a Russian immigrant. So he takes these two sides of his persona and melds them.
In the Russian community there?
Yeah. In the winter. In the winter in Milwaukee. And this guy.
Well, it felt like home.
He's so genuine, this driver, because he is just so genuinely trying to make all of this work. He's just trying to get everybody where they need to be. Mm-hmm. He's got the guy on the radio who's calling him, telling him, I'm going to fire you. Where are you at? You know, and it's just, I'm like, oh, man, it was just such a good movie.
But never mawkish.
No.
Everyone is a total human being. There's no condescension to the actors with disabilities. It's people you don't see on film very often treated with a rich, full respect. It was very exciting.
Yeah.
And I really want to stop here and acknowledge this, because more than anything else, this is the reason Film Week exists, is to spotlight films like this that you otherwise wouldn't know anything about, that would go under the radar. You'd see it on the marquee at your local Lemley, and you wouldn't, what's that about? And so I really wanted to give this its due. Give Me Liberty is at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, Lemley's Playhouse, Pasadena, and Lemley's Town Center. This is a year where we hear there have not been very many films playing at so-called art houses that have really connected with audiences. Both of our critics saying this is a movie you really need to see. And it's funny. Give Me Liberty is unrated. It's directed by Kirill Mikhanovsky, and it's written by Alice Austin and Mikhanovsky. Again, the movie unrated. Official Secrets stars Keira Knightley. The drama's based on the true story of British whistleblower Catherine Gunn. She leaked information to the media about an NSA spy operation designed to push the UN Security Council into sanctioning the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
So, you work for the British government?
No.
No?
This proposed war is historically unpopular.
I work for the British people. I do not gather intelligence so that the government can lie to the British people.
Keira Knightley, Matthew Good, Ralph Fiennes, Matt Smith, Gavin Hood, the director, Christie.
Very solid, totally respectable, well cast, well acted, slow burn political thriller potboiler. And it's just so well made across the board. Not extraordinary in any way, but just really solid and increasingly suspenseful and watchable. So Keira Knightley plays this real-life woman, Catherine Gunn, who was a British security expert, and she did intelligence and translating. She spoke several languages, and she comes across this memo in which it's clear that the U.S. is trying to get Britain to help them coerce various U.N. member nations to vote for the resolution to go to war in Iraq. And it's like Cameroon and it's Chile. And the memo suggests that, like, they're going to blackmail these countries to get their support. And she realizes how, you know, disgusting that is and how illegal and how wrong. And she leaks it to a friend who leaks it to a friend who gets it to the Observer. And it is about what happens to her and And Keira Knightley is so good in this, just as the pressure mounts on her. She's so subtle in depicting this woman's increasing anxiety and fear as everything is tightening in on her. It's a great supporting cast. Matthew Good is an editor at The Observer. Ray Fiennes is the lawyer who comes to her defense. It's very good. It's solid.
It's as solid as a rock, this movie. The Official Secrets Act of 1989 is the law under which this very young woman, she was a very young woman, Catherine Gunn, when this memo comes across her desk. And that memo said, we are going to do this. We are going to blackmail them. That's what it's going to say. She does all of this leaking. This film begins with her in the dock at her trial. Yet they managed to construct it as a thriller. For a good portion of this film, after we've seen her in the dock, we're wondering, is she going to leak the memo? Are they going to find out who leaked the memo? All of these things we know the answers to. Yeah, but nevertheless, they construct it as a thriller and still execute that. Kudos to them for that. This story has more to do with, say, what the Pentagon Papers and what Daniel Ellsberg did than, say, the Chelsea Manning case or even the Eric Snowden case. It's a very tricky catch-20, what is it, catch-22? 21, yeah. What is it? With this law, the way it's set up, if you are suspected of having leaked the document, you cannot defend yourself to that suspicion. You can't even hire a lawyer and tell the lawyer what it is you're suspected of. That's the way they set up this sort of circular logic. She was in a trap. The way it plays out is very interesting. Anybody can look it up. But the way it plays out is very interesting.
The film is Official Secrets. It's rated R, directed by Gavin Hood, one of the three credited screenwriters as well, based on the book by Marcia and Thomas Mitchell, The Spy Who Tried to Stop a War. Official Secrets is at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Also out this week, Bennett's War. We just bring it to your attention. Not available for critics to see. The film written and directed by Alex Rana Rivello. The film stars Michael Rourke and Allison Page. Also this week, the documentary Untouchable about Harvey Weinstein. Ursula McFarlane is the director. Christy?
So this is a film that gets its arms around a lot in terms of contextualizing Harvey Weinstein, why he has mattered, how he was able to wield such power for so long and keep so many people quiet for so long, and then ultimately what happened that broke down that power and allowed and gave a lot of women the strength and the bravery to come forward with their accusations against him. It doesn't necessarily say anything new, but you have a lot of interviews with people who are famous, like Rosanna Arquette and Paz de la Huerta, but also just women who were aspiring actresses who thought that a meeting with Harvey Weinstein, I mean, of course, why wouldn't you take it? Why wouldn't you go to his hotel room? And maybe it's risky, but you got to take a risk to make your way in this business. And even though it's, for some of these women, been many decades since he allegedly assaulted them, the emotions are all right there. They're all on the surface. And so to hear these women in their own voice, talking to an interviewer and recounting their experiences with this man, that is very moving and that is very powerful. But as far as actual news, there's nothing really new here, but just seeing it all collected en masse is quite compelling.
Yeah.
The film is Untouchable, new documentary. What do you think, Tim?
Well, the young Harvey Weinstein we do meet in this film when he was a music promoter. I suppose one of the things we come to know about him in this film is that he was always a brute. And he was a brute pretty much to everyone, the men too. A fella talked about him throwing an ashtray at his head.
He had one of the worst reputation of anybody in Hollywood, and that's saying something.
Yeah, our Wade Major did an extensive interview with him some many years ago. I remember him coming back and reporting to me, Harvey's insane. And I don't suppose I've ever been more uncomfortable watching women report what happened to them as I've been in this movie. Listening to these women specifically say what Harvey did to them made me deeply uncomfortable.
Untouchable, the documentary. It's streaming on Hulu starting Monday. Ursula McFarlane, the director of Untouchable. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, another documentary I've been eagerly anticipating from Stanley Nelson, Miles Davis, The Birth of the Cool. We'll find out about it in a minute. You're with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Charles Solomon, Tim Cogshell, and Christy Lemire. Next up, Stanley Nelson's documentary, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. Great musicians are interviewed, including Herbie Hancock, Carlos Santana, as they remember Miles Davis, the man, as well as his music. Tim, what'd you think?
Yeah. All of that happens in this film. Stanley, a very interesting fellow, produces several American Experience docs, Freedom Summer and the Jesse Owens doc and the Jonestown doc.
I like his work a lot.
His work is very, 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 very good. And this, aggregated, is very insightful about Miles Davis, who happens to be from East St. Louis, Illinois. But the presentation of all of this information more or less works like this. Here's Miles Davis, this genius. A seminal genius in music. And Miles Davis was also this aggrieved black man, a dark-skinned black man who had good reason to be aggrieved. And Miles Davis beat up women. That's the order in which these things are presented. That's the incorrect order. Miles Davis beat up all his women. Every single one of those women, Cicely Tyson, his second wife, who's in this film here, that anger that he had somehow translated into a thing that came out in aggression toward these women. And I just feel like we need to understand that first. And then we can talk about Miles Davis, the super duper genius and all that kind of stuff, whose career lasted until the end of his life. He was innovating all the way through the end of his life.
And there's not just one Miles Davis.
No, there are a number of Miles Davis. He was a metamorphosis. And he kept himself juxtaposed to very young people, very young musicians. And he always let them take the lead. He would fall in behind whatever they were doing. And so when they started doing fusion, Miles was like, oh, and Miles did not look back at all. He just did not bother to look back. He also just wasn't very aware of what kind of a human being he was in the world. A quote from Miles Davis. My wife read this to me once. Miles was asked, Miles, how do you want to die? Miles, with my hands around a white man's neck. Miles Davis said that. To say that, it tells you something about what he suffered as a young black man from a fairly well-to-do family, by the way.
His father was a dentist.
Yeah. But you know, being a dark brown black man, it's hard.
Well, it's fascinating to hear even his friends talk about him or musicians who performed with him and the complexities of Miles and the difficulties of him. Charles?
Now, I found this one very interesting, but also at times frustrating because someone will come in. There's the French actress that he was apparently madly in love with for a while, and then she just disappears. And I guess it was his first wife with whom he had two or three kids. They mention her, then she disappears out of his life. And I wish that they had just kept their lines a little better traced. They've assembled an incredible array of musicians, you know, and people who actually knew him and worked with him. And they talk about his drug abuse and his violence towards women and even the women themselves. Was it his second wife who was the dancer? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Frances Taylor.
Yeah.
She's a hoot.
Yeah, who had been in the original cast of West Side Story. And he made her quit because he didn't want any competition for her attention, or I suspect for her getting attention as an artist, too. She sticks around more than most of these other figures. But I wish, again, it's interesting. I just wish it had been a little more coherent in some ways. And they don't always tell us when he's doing things that, oh, well, he was doing this with, you know, he and so-and-so were doing this, and this was new, and this kind of riff was different. Okay, when was that? You know, and then how does that transfer to other musicians at this time? So I learned a lot from it, but I felt I could have learned more.
I learned a lot, too. I did not know a lot about Miles Davis going into this, admittedly, but it does try to get its arms around a giant life and a complicated, lengthy life. And it is a little superficial in that regard because it is trying to hit every stage of this person's career over many, many decades. But I do appreciate that they give a lot of time to Frances Taylor, who is just a hoot and a half. She's hilarious, and she matches him in terms of ego, in terms of sense of self, and I guess you would have to. And every single woman, you point out that he abused all his women, Tim.
Cicely Tyson, right. Who's not in the movie. I mean, she's in the movie,
but not in the movie. You see footage of her. But they all walked away from him eventually.
Yeah.
Well, everyone left him despite his greatness.
Not, interesting, she's not interviewed
not
in the film.
Carl Lumley,
tells you something. Yeah.
The wonderful Carl Lumley providing this raspy voice over of Miles, and he's just killing it. It's wonderful.
About a week ago, I heard a musician who was playing a gig with Miles describing experience. They just start performing, and Miles isn't feeling all that well that night, and he just walks off the stage, just leaves the gig, walks up and out of the auditorium and just leaves. And never comes back. And so the next day, the review in the local newspaper, the brilliant Miles Davis makes this great statement and walks up. And so the guy, the musician, is telling the story, says, shows it to Miles. Miles just nods and said, "That's right." Like, you ran the whole thing, as opposed to he just didn't want to play. The movie is Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It's unrated at the Landmark in West Los Angeles. The comedy Before You Know It, directed by Hannah Pearl Utt, who co-wrote the screenplay with Jen Tulloch, stars Utt as well as Tulloch and Mandy Patinkin. Christy?
So Before You Know It is an incredibly bland and forgettable title, especially for a movie at the end of August, but there's a lot going on here that is very worthwhile, so don't let this slip through the cracks, because it's, you know, is this like a movie with Matthew McConaughey and Sarah Jessica Parker? No, this is a new thing. So Hannah Pearl Utt, this is her first film she's ever directed, and she and Jen Tulloch are longtime creative partners, and they co-wrote the script, and they co-star as sisters who are in this really codependent relationship with each other and with their father, played by Mandy Patinkin, who is larger than life force in their life. They all still live in their childhood home in this brownstone above this Greenwich Village theater where they all also work. And so Mandy Patinkin is the patriarch and the playwright, and Hannah Pearl Utt is the stage manager and the voice of reason, and very buttoned down, very modest. And Jen Tulloch is sort of the wild, brash, flirtatious sister actress who wears denim miniskirts that are way too short for her. And this is not a spoiler, but the father dies early on. And the sisters discover that the mother they always thought was dead is actually alive, and she's a soap opera star.
Yeah.
Played by Judith Light. Which is a really cool bit of casting, right? Given that's how she got her start, was on One Life to Live in the 70s and 80s. And she gives this very showy kind of aging soap diva performance. But what's amazing here is how Hannah Pearl Utt makes these tonal shifts that would seem really, really tricky and difficult, and she makes them pretty seamlessly. Because the movie begins, it's kind of quirky, and then it's sad, and then it's a mystery, and then it's wacky again, and then it's just totally surreal. And you are along with them. It's a very lived-in New York. The production design on their brownstone is so vivid. Like, every room is so ornate and sort of falling apart, and you feel like you live there with them, and she'll follow them through the hallways to indicate who they are and how they live. It's a really nice little gem of a film.
Yeah, she has a deaf hand as a director, Hannah has here, as well as an actress, you know, as the taciturn sister with her flamboyant sister and her father, who's just this guy. You know, he's one of this kind of a famous playwright, but also very noted as this actor. And there's a chance that one of his plays might be produced at a real theater, you know, not the one that's in the basement, you know, but they would like him to take a look at and rewrite this one scene, one thing in one scene, and he just won't do it. And Hannah Pearl just, what is wrong with you?
We know this man,
too. Oh, don't we? And then he has the audacity to just up and die, which, as you said, is not, and it just throws everything into a tizzy. And the flamboyant sister is also a lousy mother. She has this daughter.
Who's 12,
and who is the most reasonable and rational person in the entire movie. The 12-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. Before You Know It, the comedy at the Landmark, it's unrated, the Landmark in West L.A. Neja, a Chinese animated fantasy film, Yu Yang, the director and co-screenwriter, Charles.
Well, this broke box office records in China, and I'm not entirely sure why. It's a fantasy based on a Ming Dynasty novel about the founding of the dynasty that will unify China under the Wicked Emperor. Same setting that we talked about 2 weeks ago with Kingdom. But there are supernatural prophecies. There are enchanted seeds and eggs from the immortals. There are dragons. There are curses. And it's very hard to make any sense of. They've clearly been looking at DreamWorks and to a lesser degree Disney and Illumination films, And they're borrowing lots of bits. There are pee jokes. There are snot jokes. Lots of flatulence jokes. But they really aren't telling the story. And I think the biggest problem is that none of the characters are at all sympathetic. The title character is this horrible brat who delights in tormenting people with his supernatural powers. His parents lie to him and tell him he's really the embodiment of the pearl of virtue when he's not, quite obviously. Nobody's honest, nobody's sympathetic, and it's almost 2 hours long. And a lot of it, you just feel like you're wandering some trackless wilderness.
Ne Zha is the Chinese animation film. It's at the Regal Edwards Alhambra, the AMC Santa Anita in Arcadia, and the TCL Chinese Theaters Hollywood. It's unrated. The documentary, Friedkin Uncut, looks at the life and films of William Friedkin, who did The Exorcist, among other movies. Christy?
So William Friedkin's just such a hoot. I know I keep saying the word hoot, but he really is.
Oh, yeah.
And there's so much of him.
Oh,
my God. Just the raconteur. He's just so brash and so profane, and yet you want him to just keep going. There's such personality there. So it is just a look back at a lot of his films, The Exorcist, The French Connection, and then most recent stuff like Killer Joe, mm-hmm. interviews with other directors like Coppola, like Wes Anderson, Edgar Wright, talking about what an influence Friedkin was, but also actors who work with him, Matthew McConaughey. We have to remember that William Friedkin created the McConaissance when he cast Matthew McConaughey as a bad guy in Killer Joe. Mm-hmm. So it's just clips of his films and him telling stories, and it's very enjoyable.
Yeah. What's the movie that with the truck on the bridge ready to that's the Sorcerer.
Sorcerers, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
With the dynamite in it.
Yeah, which has kind of a cult following.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the best freaking films. Here's the thing, I know him a little bit. I've interviewed him many times. The funny thing about it, and it's true of this movie, every sentence has at least three curse words. You know? And I remember interviewing him for a thing. I'm trying to cut this interview. I'm like, Jesus Christ, William. Come on, man. Pull it in a little bit. But he curses all the way through this movie. It's indicative of his filmmaking style, which was, I don't care. I'm doing it my way style. He cast William Peterson mm-hmm. in To Live and Die in L.A. William Peterson was a nobody,
yeah.
theater actor. And he didn't care. He just cast it. He's the right guy for the movie. And that's the way he made movies. Broke laws like you don't want to when you, with that chase scene. Just breaking all kinds of
French
laws.
Connection.
The French Connection. Uh-huh. Just breaking all kinds of traffic laws. But man, have you ever seen a chase scene like that? So that's who he is, has always been, and is now.
And as Christy says, a great raconteur, no question. Friedkin Uncut, the film's unrated, Lemley's music hall, Beverly Hills. The Fanatic, about a rabid film fan who stalks his favorite action hero, John Travolta, Devon Sawa, Anna Golja star. Christy?
This is the worst movie of the year, quite possibly, but it absolutely must be experienced. You have to see this for yourself. John Travolta plays a man who is somewhere on the autism spectrum who is also celebrity obsessed, and he stalks this action star played by Devon Sawa and becomes increasingly insistent. It is Rain Man meets Misery. It is terrible. Fred Durst directed this. Former Limp Bizkit yeah. frontman Fred Durst directed this.
Following in Rob Zombie's footsteps.
Yes, the depiction of somebody on the spectrum is reprehensible in the way that he is bullied, he is vilified, he is made fun of, and it's not to set an example of how horribly some folks are treated. Travolta is mannered and screechy and shrill. I don't know what he was thinking. And he was in character on set the whole time. You got to see
this
it.
This a must see. The Fanatic. Starring John Travolta. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge, Hollywood. Coming up, John Horne joins us from the Telluride Film Festival. Yeah, it's where the most acclaimed films of the year play. We'll get the preview coming up. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Wonderful to have you with us this weekend. Well, it's small but mighty. The Telluride Film Festival brings together film lovers and people in the business from around the world. And they're known at the festival for choosing many of the films that end up as Best Picture nominees, including the ultimate winner. Though that didn't happen last year, up until then they had an extraordinary streak. And the Frame's John Horne is with us from Telluride to talk about the films he's had a chance to see. John, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
What is about the festival first that enables them to get access to so many of the films that end up as nominees?
I think obviously they have pretty good taste. And a lot of those films you would be hard to categorize in any one genre. I mean, Best Picture winners like Argo, The King's Speech, 12 Years a Slave, Birdman, Shape of Water have all premiered at Telluride. And they're incredibly different films, but I guess you could all say they're very much driven by a single filmmaker's vision. And also, I think they can be really picky about what it is that they are taking. I mean, a couple of years ago, they showed a movie called Moonlight that was not on anybody's radar. And Barry Jenkins, who is kind of a longtime Telluride friend, came here with that movie. It obviously went on to win Best Picture, unless you believe La La Land really did. And because the festival is so small, they only show about, you know, a couple dozen new movies. They can really be selective. And even though they're not casting a really wide net like festivals in Toronto that follow Telluride, they seem to have a really good sense of picking movies that are going to resonate not only with audiences, but also with awards voters.
Well, let's talk about some of the ones from this 46th annual Telluride Film Festival in the Colorado Rockies. Judy, which is based on a musical production that I actually saw, End of the Rainbow, stars Renee Zellweger as a late career, late life Judy Garland. Rupert Gold is the director of the film adaptation. John, what'd you think of Judy?
I guess I have to be careful because in about 2 minutes, Renee Zellweger is going to come in and talk with us about making this film. It is a really interesting movie. I mean, I think what's interesting about Judy Garland is a lot of people have this image in their mind of who she was and the life she led. And this is a movie, as you say, based on, you know, the late stages of her life. She's doing a series of concerts in London. She's struggling with sobriety. She's struggling with child custody issues. She's basically insolvent. And yet you see, you know, the glimpses of her true talent, though, even though she's kind of stumbling around through a lot of the film, Judy Garland still has an amazing voice. Renee Zellweger completely inhabits the role, and she does all of the singing in the film. And I think it's certainly a movie that is going to get Renee Zellweger, who took a long hiatus from Hollywood. It was about 5 or 6 years where she didn't really make anything. She's now coming back and has a pretty full plate. And I think this is a movie that is going to be incredibly well received. I'm doing a conversation with Renee at the festival this evening where she's getting a career tribute, which seems early for somebody her age, but so be it.
All right. So two chances to talk with her, and you'll have multiple chances to hear John's interview Friday afternoon on The Frame, or you can hear it via the link on our Film Week page, kpecc.org. Noah Baumbach has a new film out about divorce, Marriage Story, with Scarlett Johansson, Adam Driver, and Laura Dern. This could be a tough sell at the box office, but it sounds promising on the screen.
It is a very good movie, and it's called Marriage Story. It probably should be called Divorce Story. I think it's semi-autobiographical about Noah Baumbach's marriage. He has always kind of incorporated things from his own life into his films. It played just before Telluride at the Venice Film Festival, where it got crazy good reviews. I ran into Ted Sarandos at Netflix last night. This is a Netflix movie, and he was ecstatic over the critical reception this film had received. Yes, it is kind of a tricky sell. It's not like every moviegoer in America wants to go out and see a film about a marriage falling apart and about the divorce proceedings, but it's incredibly well made. Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson play the couple at the center of it. Laura Dern and Alan Alda play their respective divorce lawyers. It is a critics movie that I think is going to get a lot of awards attention, and it's really quite good.
Marriage Story. Ford versus Ferrari. I'm really looking forward to this, in which Matt Damon plays Carroll Shelby.
Yeah, this is about a famous, I guess you could call it, duel between Henry Ford II and Enzo Ferrari. And it all plays out at the Battle of Le Mans, the 24-hour race in 1966. Matt Damon plays Carroll Shelby. Christian Bale plays his star driver, a guy named Ken Miles. And it's about the lead up of this race and how much is at stake between Ford and Ferrari. It's a story about two guys, Shelby and Miles, and about how determined they are to win this race, and also about all the interference that Ford is giving them, how they want to manage, you know, the race, how they want to make sure that the Ford public image is not jeopardized through what these guys are doing off the track. It's directed by James Mangold, who made a fantastic movie called Logan not that long ago. If anybody likes car racing, they're going to like this movie. And it's also kind of a great story about entrepreneurship, about what it takes to kind of work within a massive corporation like Ford and do something that is, you know, not expected and bend the rules to get the results you need.
And that's coming up November release expected in theaters. Parasite, the South Korean comedy drama. This played earlier, right? Was it at Venice this screened?
It was at Cannes, and it won a big award there. This is the same director who made a film called Okja about a giant pig. He also made a movie called Snowpiercer. This is a crazy movie about a family that essentially moves into a rich family's house unbeknownst to the family and starts running their lives. It is completely original. Really disturbing. It has kind of a gothic ending. It's a Korean film. It's in Korean language, but it is absolutely going to be probably Korea's foreign language submission for the Oscars. It's a very original film, very disturbing. I took my 15-year-old son back in Los Angeles to see it, and I think he reported only two nightmares so far.
Okay, Parasite, film from South Korea. The Assistant, starring Julia Garner, Kitty Green, the writer-director. Tell us about that,
now,
please.
This is a movie I have not seen, and it's premiering later this weekend. A lot of people are very interested in this film. It sounds as if it is a fictional film based on somebody who works for somebody who sounds a lot like Harvey Weinstein, somebody who is kind of caught up in a Me Too scandal. It is premiering over the weekend. I haven't seen it. I'm super excited to go see it. It's made by Kitty Green, who made a very interesting movie not that long ago called Casting John Bonet. It stars Julia Garner. A very topical film, and who knows what assistant she could be. She could be Les Moonves' assistant. She could be Harvey Weinstein's assistant. She could be Matt Lauer's assistant. You take your pick of any men, powerful men who've been implicated for sexual harassment and assault.
The Assistant, Waves, romantic film written and directed by Trey Edward Schultz.
Now, he's an interesting filmmaker. He made a very scary movie not that long ago called It Comes at Night. And this is a movie with a really good cast, including Sterling K. Brown. Again, another movie that will premiere late tonight is its first screening on Friday night. Again, I haven't seen it. Not a lot of people have seen it. Trey Edward Schultz is a very interesting filmmaker. I'm looking forward to it. His last movie was very scary. I think this movie is going to be pretty intense, but it's definitely on my must-see list for the weekend.
Okay, we've got just over a minute left. I'm really interested in The Gift, The Journey of Johnny Cash, Tom Zimney's documentary, but what are the docs you're most interested in?
I would point out two, both of which I've seen. There is a documentary about Linda Ronstadt called The Sound of My Voice, which is about her musical career. If you don't know, Linda Ronstadt was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's. But it's really a story about her musical career and all the very different things she did. And then there's a movie called The Kingmaker, which is from director Lauren Greenfield, and it's about Imelda Marcos. And you think that Imelda Marcos is kind of done with the Philippines. You would be mistaken. And not only is she very prominent in everything that's going on in the Philippines and with its new leader, Duterte, but her son, who is called Bongbong, could very well be the country's next vice president. Lauren Greenfield had incredible access to Imelda Marcos in the making of this movie. It's remarkable. It's a really disturbing film, and Imelda Marcos has not gone away. In fact, she might be more powerful now than she ever has been.
The Kingmaker is the film. John, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your extensive coverage of the Telluride Film Festival from the Colorado Rockies, that during the frame here on 89.3 KPCC, and again to hear John's interview with Renee Zellweger either Friday afternoons, the frame broadcast, or the link on our Film Week page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We're just talking with the Frame's John Horn about potential Oscar nominees that are being shown this weekend at the Telluride Film Festival. But what about what we've seen so far? You know, it's been a tough year at movie theaters, as we talked about last week on Film Week, the box office at Art house theaters has been way down, very difficult for films aimed at adult audiences to really catch on. But as we continue with our critics, let's find out what they think about some of the highlights of the year. Charles, let me start with you. Okay. For animation, what kind of years have been?
It's been a weird year of either super hits like How to Train Your Dragon 3, Toy Story 4, the CG version of Lion King have, you know, just printed money. But then you also had Ugly Dolls and Wonder Park and Missing Link that were complete bombs. A couple of big question marks still coming up. Frozen 2 from Disney. Klaus, a film by a Spanish director, Sergio Pablo, looks gorgeous. Does it have a story? We don't know yet. The other film that's gotten a lot of critical attention, winning a lot of prizes in Europe, is the independent I Lost My Body, about a Moroccan immigrant in France who loses his hand in a work accident. But it's essentially told from the severed hand's point of view. It's odd, but it's really intriguing.
Now, something you're never going to see made in America, right?
No, no. Makoto Shinkai's new film, Weathering With You, he broke all sorts of records in Japan with Your Name, is going to be Japan's official entry in the Oscars. Very interesting film, but it's not going to be released here wide until 2020. The one film it's very obvious that Toy Story 4 and Dragons and very likely Frozen, if it's at all good, will be Oscar nominees for feature. The question is more what will go in the kind of independent slot. But in animated shorts, if I were going to place a bet, I would say Hair Love, which we talked about 2 weeks ago, getting a lot of attention, an absolutely charming film. I would say it's a good shot for a nomination for short. I don't know all of what it's going to be up against, but it's such a lovely film. I hope it gets the recognition.
Christy, what are your favorites so far this year?
So I keep a running list all year long of like potential top 10 contenders, and I've already got a solid dozen movies that I've really loved, and we haven't even gotten to some of the big fall releases that John was talking about in your interview with him. I love The Farewell. I love The Last Black Man in San Francisco. I love Loose. Midsummer is tremendous, and there's an even longer cut out there now. If you want more disturbing imagery in your eyeballs, there's more to be had. But there's been a couple of really great documentaries, too, in Apollo 11.
Oh, yeah.
And I would count Beyoncé's Homecoming in that, even though I think it just aired on Netflix. And Honeyland, which we talked about here several weeks ago, the Macedonian beekeeper documentary. So, and I love Give Me Liberty, which we talked about earlier in the show. That's a possibility for me for a top 10. So I think it's been a really good year for smaller, challenging, really diverse fare.
But it's just unfortunate that they had a tough time, unless they've been streaming, to get that theatrical audience.
It is hard. And we can only do so much to get folks out the door and go to the theater. And some movies really you should see in a theater. And it's hard. I understand that.
Yeah, Tim.
Yeah, well, let me go ahead and give props to the two biggies of the year, Captain Marvel and Endgame. Outstanding work. Outstanding work, these two tentpole films. They were every bit as good, and particularly the Endgame sort of bringing to a finale, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Deeply moving. I found it to be an absolutely wonderful love story, that movie, about fathers and daughters and all kinds of family, despite all those foolishness with Tesseract rocks and Infinity Stones or whatever. That movie rose above all of that and was something else. And then, and its box office shows it, and as you say, the box office for some other movies don't. So a little movie like Booksmart, about these two little girls. And it's just this wonderful, wonderful, touchy little movie. The box office should have been better for that movie. More folks should have went and seen it. Always Be My Maybe. I love the construction of this movie, sort of Asian-constructed movie about this young couple who are eventually going to fall in love. It's a standard love story. Now, that movie played on Netflix while it was in theaters, which might have been the problem with its box office at theaters because, you know, it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Us was a fantastic movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, as you say, and that documentary, Apollo 11, which played in theaters and made money. So these things are kind of complicated right now.
Yeah, and that was one that did do quite well, but it had such a great tie-in, the anniversary.
Well, it also is just such a good movie that I think we all talked about it on Film Week earlier, that although you knew what was going to happen, that was one suspenseful film. Even though you had seen the footage of Neil Armstrong, you were there. Are they going to get there? Are they going to get back safe? It was just such a good film.
And far and away better than the narrative version, First Man, which one one would think, you know.
But it made me appreciate First Man.
Yeah.
The top five highest grossing films thus far, 2019, Avengers Endgame, Lion King, the CGI version, Toy Story 4, Captain Marvel, and Spider-Man. So you see the kind of films people are going out to see. There's not just sort of a... an adult drama in that mix.
Because they're safe, right? They're known quantities, and, you know, people, that's why they, people keep making more of them. There's always more to be made.
Now, none of you mentioned Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
A film that I enjoyed, but I can see how it would not necessarily be a film that would have brought that many people out to see it. It's an acquired taste for Quentin Tarantino.
It broke records at Quentin Tarantino's movie theater on Beverly Boulevard.
I could see why. Yeah, absolutely. What are you most looking forward to? You mentioned some, Charles. You're looking forward to seeing. Tim, what are you looking forward to the rest of the year?
Top of my list is Dolomite, the Dolomite movie starring Eddie Murphy, which looks like a poignant movie with a performance that understands that Rudy Ray Moore was the person who created a character called Dolomite, which sometimes we confuse. A man over 40 years old, balding, willed himself into becoming a filmmaker, starred himself in those movies, doing all kinds of outrageous things.
I just think of the scene in Dolomite where he spends like 5 minutes taking his clothes off.
And just, you know, the guts to actually do that.
Yeah.
And basically created a genre within a genre, the black exploitation karate comedy thriller drama. It's what Rudy Ray Moore invented. And on his dying day, owned the negatives to every one of those movies. That's an extraordinary. So looking forward to seeing that quite a lot. Joker, sans Batman. The story of how the Joker became the Joker. You know, Thomas Wayne is involved in this film, so it's years before
I love
Batman.
Origin stories.
Yeah, like you know, and there are other origin stories for Joker. If you watch Gotham, there's one, and the Tim Burton movie. But this looks like a dead serious movie. And Terminator Dark Fate. Why? Because Arnold is in it, because Linda Hamilton is in it with a shotgun, and because Ed Furlong is in it. That's that central thing. And I love McKenzie as well. So looking forward to see if they can bring that back around.
Chris, what are you looking forward to?
The Lighthouse. When I saw the trailer for The Lighthouse, my heart jumped out of my chest. It looks so incredibly beautiful. And the idea of Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe at a lighthouse in like grainy black and white is so exciting to me. Also, Parasite, which John Horn mentioned a little bit ago, and Knives Out, I'm psyched about. And I'll admit, I'm excited about the new Star Wars. Mm. How are they going to end it?
All right. Yeah, should be
Will
exciting.
Nope.
I can't imagine. All right. We have a lot of films to look forward to, and you're going to hear about them week by week, of course, right here on Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. My thanks to our critics this week, Christy Lemire, Tim Cox, and Charles Solomon. We're here every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon for the full hour of Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We wish you a terrific Labor Day weekend.